Good afternoon or good evening, everybody. My name is Fiona McMillan, and you see the title of my presentation here on the screen. I'm going to make an argument that the way in which largely Western intellectual property scholars and commentators have treated what we refer to as traditional cultural expressions has amounted to a new form of post-colonial marginalization of Indigenous peoples, which of course has had negative effects on Indigenous peoples, but also has had negative effects on other marginalized creative communities or communities, and in the end has actually had negative effects on all of us. So that's my argument. Now, in the introductory chapter of their excellent book, Laura Murray, Tina Piper, and Kirsty Robinson are commenting on the reluctance of non-Indigenous intellectual property scholars to reflect on the broader significance of the Indigenous experience of community-based regulation of knowledge and cultural production. And so I've extracted here a little bit of what they wrote. We contend that the respectful impulse to treat Indigenous cultural property laws and practices as sui generis, so meaning in law, one of a kind, sui generis, has limited their critical reach and comparative power. We reject the binary view that would presume Western people to be entirely comfortable or hegemonized by IP law, and Indigenous or non-Western people to be alienated from it. The reality is much more complex. Now, in this, as in many things, we might say that non-Indigenous cultural commentators were lagging behind a number of their Indigenous counterparts, and perhaps more importantly, lagging behind cultural communities whose lived experience and practice reflects and articulates the fact of cultural cohabitation and the consequent status of not being, as legal scholars perhaps would like them to be, sui generis. Now, I want to talk about this, as you would have seen from my title, in the context of the Australian band, Yothu Yindi. Yothu Yindi was formed from the merger of two bands. One of those bands was composed of musicians from the Yolngu people, from the Arnhem Land in Northern Australia. And the other was a non-Indigenous Australian band called the Swamp Jockeys, very Australian name. The band was active from 1985 until 2013. It enjoyed very significant chart success in Australia. It was inducted into the Australian Recording Industry Association Hall of Fame. And all those reasons are reasons I want to talk about it. But the other thing that's interesting about this band is that it made extensive use of Yolngu songs, instruments, and dance, as well as cultural images of the Yolngu people. And the band blended all those things with the sounds and instruments of mainstream rock music. And I'd just like to give you, play a couple of clips for you in order to demonstrate what I mean. So this is from Living in the Mainstream. Nope, did it work? Okay, I've lost one of my clips here, but let me see if I can find it. Okay, and here's another one. This is the one that I meant to play
first.
Sicily,
and that's Yothu Yindi. Its own name means mother and child.
Thank you. It's hard for me not to play all of these because I love these songs. However, they're subject to copyright, of course, so I only want to play a small amount of them. Okay, so what Yothu Yindi were doing, very importantly, in the post-colonial situation, was that they wrote and performed music that reflected precisely on the post-colonial situation of Indigenous Australians, including the necessity and reality of cohabitation with white settler Australians, of which I might say I'm one, although I don't live in Australia anymore. One of their most famous songs, Treaty, the first clip I played was song Treaty from the 1991 Tribal Voice album, reflects upon the bicentenary in 1988 of the invasion or colonization of Australia by British settlers, calling for a treaty between Indigenous peoples and settler Australians. Because this was never recognized, as you may know, as an invasion. This song is a characteristic mix of lyrics in English and in Martha, which is the language of the Yolngu people. And you heard a few of the words before, but you hear, this is from the first verse. I heard it on the radio, I saw it on the television back in 1988, all those talking politicians. Words are easy, words are cheap, much cheaper than our priceless land, but promises can disappear like writing in the sand. And a bit further into the song, they have a lot of gems in this song. The planting of the Union Jack never changed our law at all. Okay, the song that gives its name to the Tribal Voice album, which you also heard a bit of, is all in English, rather than being partly in Martha, but it invokes the spirits of the ancestors and the power that they give to contemporary dreams. All the people in the world are dreaming. Get up, stand up. Some of us cry for rights of survival, saying, come on, come on, stand up for your rights. And then repeatedly urging in the refrain, you better listen to your tribal voice. Okay, now, one could describe Yothu Yindi as using a blend of traditional cultural expressions of the Yolngu people and Western musical tropes. But I think that's a problematic description, or it's at least a description that we might want to investigate a little bit. And here are three questions, since I only have 15 minutes, that we might want to think about a bit more. One is, why don't we describe their music as a blend of traditional Yolngu cultural expressions and traditional Western cultural expressions, bearing in mind that rock music, as well as pop music, by the 1990s was extremely well-established musical form. Secondly, in any case, what work is the word traditional, wherever you choose to put it, doing in such formulations? And thirdly, what happens when what are described as traditional cultural expressions are used in explicit and contemporary political speech? Because that is what Yothu Yindi was doing. The Yothu Yindi song that I quote in the title to this presentation, along with many other of their very thoughtful and interesting lyrics, and the use of Yolngu cultural practices, suggests to me this band had reflected extensively on these questions and had some answers. The band members are, after all, experts in the use of community cultural forms as contemporary political speech. They always knew they were living in what we might call, in brackets, the cohabiting mainstream. And this is the first verse of Living in the Mainstream. Reflections in the water we see, black and white, living together, sharing dreams of red, black and gold, which refers to the Indigenous flag. Living dream time now is the Yolngu way. The use of what we, by which I mean Western scholars and commentators on IP, the use of what we think of as traditional cultural expressions as explicitly political speech about the post-colonial condition of Indigenous peoples transforms those traditional cultural expressions, I suggest, into contemporary rather than traditional forms. And this transposition invokes the tensions between the interests of community in culture and the interests of private intellectual property rights holders. And that tension is the hallmark of most contemporary cultural works. That's the complex reality that Murray, Piper, and Robertson refer to in the quotation with which I opened this presentation. But it's a complex reality not only for Indigenous peoples, not only for other non-Western communities, not only for other marginalized communities, it's a complex reality for all of us. As intellectual property scholars, of which I am one, in most cases not Indigenous peoples, our obsession with this concept of the traditional cultural expression as sui generis, as one of a kind, has resulted in the labeling of the cultural practices of Indigenous peoples as somehow not contemporary, not part of the mainstream, which I suppose we mean, by which we must mean Western, even when we know that the political battles around culture and language are extremely contemporary, and that Indigenous peoples have as much right to be part of the mainstream, if they choose to be, as anybody else. This obsession with this notion of traditional has been at a very substantial cost to our larger understanding of the relationship between community interests in cultural practices and private interests in intellectual property rights. In fact, Martin Kretschmer mentioned this in the panel discussion before. As Murray, Piper, and Robertson argue, we have failed to learn from Indigenous peoples, casting them and their cultural practices as only traditional, whatever that means, I don't know what it means, and therefore sui generis, and acting as though there's nothing traditional in Western cultural practice. As we know, Indigenous peoples were, their position is particular, they were the victims of sometimes extreme violence and always injustice in the colonial period, and that included the extensive dispossession of their lands and the attempt to suppress or destroy their cultures and identities. Their post-colonial condition is to be peoples without a state and so lacking political self-determination. That is particular about Indigenous people, but it's that very condition and their ongoing resistance to cultural suppression that means they must, and they have in many cases, found a way to reconcile their own laws on community management of cultural production with intellectual property rights that may belong to community members as a result of the Western legal regimes under which they often live. Instead of paying attention to the management of this complex relationship by Indigenous peoples, instead of learning from it, we act as though, instead, it's got nothing to do with us. Our lives are not like that. We act as though we in the West have no traditional culture or even any contemporary cultural heritage. We act as though all contemporary cultural production can be effectively mediated through the intellectual property system, although in the panel before we've just heard that it can't, but we like to think that way. We fail to see that systems of cultural property and intellectual property have different ways of measuring value. The question of value was also mentioned just about 10 minutes ago. And that according to this way of understanding the world, the value of contemporary cultural production inside the intellectual property system can only ever be an artifact of the market measured in terms of the economic value of a property right conferred by law. That's okay, but is that the only value that we give to our culture? What are the results of this failure to learn from the experiences of Indigenous peoples? One particularly important one is that in Western legal systems, we have failed to develop the type of meaningful concept of community rights in cultural property that can resist the creeping privatization of everything in our cultural landscape through intellectual property rights. And the consequences of that failure, the failure to develop a strong idea of community rights and culture that can defend the so-called commons or the public domain, the consequences of that failure might be some of the following. The commodification of much of our culture, a high degree of corporate ownership over vast swathes of the traditional and contemporary intangible cultural heritage of the West, as well as of Indigenous peoples. An inability to challenge dominant narratives in the portrayal of our cultural heritage because the fair dealing and other defences have become so weak. the substantial shortchanging of individual authors by a system that favours those who invest in the production and distribution of cultural works over the interests of those who create them, and the absence of any real legal concept of community-produced cultural works. Perhaps, instead of marginalising Indigenous people yet again by calling their practices only traditional, by describing them as sui generis, that is, by lawyers describing them that way, we might be advised to look much more closely at the accommodation the members of such communities, who all have their own law, the members of such communities have reached in order to balance community rights to culture with individual economic claims to particular parts of that culture by community members. In other words, instead of largely non-Indigenous scholars and commentators telling Indigenous people what to do, perhaps we might listen to them and learn something from them. Thank you very much.